Yeah, we shall begin. Erev Tov, everybody. It's 8:31. Okay, class number 10, correct? 11. I'm sorry, I lost track. Okay.
I think it's 11. Today is the November 8th. Hello, everyone. I believe it's 10. Yeah. 11. I believe it's 11. Yeah. We spoke a bit about KI. So I saw a reference in one of Zev Elif's articles about this book, Keyleth Israel, the First 100 Years. Lo and behold, the synagogue was nice enough to send me a copy of it for free. And anyone who's interested or grew up there, there's a lot of good pictures. But for our purposes, it describes the whole mechitza, getting rid of the mechitza. And this is what I love. In 1925, they have the KI, Keyleth Israel Chronicle. There's an appeal from the president saying, I want to appeal to the young men and women of this community, the so-called, quote, victors. That is because they got rid of the mechitza, that they must at once show their interest as they have promised that they would do if this congregation will fulfill their wish. There now is no excuse for anyone to stay away, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, they were saying that if you get rid of the mechitza and let us sit together as a family, we'll come to Shomor. And the women were saying, especially the women, he's saying the ladies too, that I plead with the ladies of the community who were so eager to sit with their husbands. The women were saying, we're going to come to Shul too. And lo and behold, they take away the mechitza and they're not coming. So he has an open letter to them. It reminds me, I have a friend who is involved in this thing they call the partnership minyanim. So they do something which I don't understand. I think it's strange. Or at least they started doing it. I don't think it continues. Where they said that they weren't gonna continue after Yishtabach or Shochanad Shabbos morning, I should say, until they have not just 10 men but 10 women. And the problem is they weren't getting 10 women. Can you blame them? Get there by 9:20? I mean, if you're not going to, if they know they're not really at the same level and requirement of davening, it's a little hard to get people to come that early, I would think. But so that's the thing. I think they had to get rid of that. I want to show you something now. I thank Rabbi Asakoff from West Orange, New Jersey. Who, hold on a second. I want to pull up the right one here. Okay, Rabbi, he's been very involved in Gittin, in conservative movement. He sends me this. Instead of the Lieberman ketubah, this is now very popular. It's the Tanai B'Kiddushin. And this is what many conservative rabbis use. And it says, like, at the end, if our marriage should be terminated by decree of the civil courts, and if by expiration of 6 months after such a decree, I do not give you a divorce according to the laws of Moses and the people of Israel, then our betrothal and our marriage will have been null and void. This is what we call Hafkas Kiddushin. This is what the Orthodox rabbis never accepted, although there's the Berkovitz proposal and others. So the Orthodox, the Rabbonim, can say that if they need to, that the marriage is not halachically binding, and therefore you don't have a case of mamzerus if you go through with this and adultery. But this is the conservative rabbinate does not go really use the Lieberman agreement. Ketubah, I was told, even with the updated, they use this Tanai B'Kiddushin, conditional marriage. Okay, many of you were interested in cheerleaders. So let me show you some things here. First of all, anyone interested, you can read Jeffrey Gurok's book, Judaism's Encounter with American Sports. And from about page 141 on, he talks about this. The interesting thing is there was something called the Metropolitan Jewish High School League. Now we call it the Yeshiva League. Mesifta Chaim Berlin joined it. And the thing is that Chaim Berlin was playing against schools like Ramaz and the rest, and they did have cheerleaders there. At my school, JC, I still remember this. We used to play Catholic schools in basketball. In those days, you didn't have enough teams really to have only play yeshiva teams. So once the Catholic school comes with, the girls come with all, they come with their cheerleaders, and Rabbi Teitz told them, no go. But I want to show you a picture. Let me show you a couple pictures here. People have in their mind, they're thinking of maybe the Dallas Cowboys or something, but no, that's not what I'm talking about. Here is Central, it's the oldest girls yeshiva, if you want to use that word, in America. Founded, it was in Brooklyn. Later, they opened one in Manhattan. There was also a BTA. BTA is Alan Dershowitz went to BT, many others. So here's from the picture from Gurok's book. This is the cheerleading squad from 1953. I don't think anyone would find any problems with their dress. Now they would go, as Gurok describes it, they go to the BTA games. That's the boys, Brooklyn Town Musical Academy. And then they even would perform at YU games. Incidentally, some of you might have seen today the article on ESPN.com, all about Yeshiva University. Granted, it's Division III, but they have the record for most 36 games unbeaten streak in college basketball. And it's a whole big article about YU's basketball team. Now, I went online. Unfortunately, the Ramaz yearbooks, you can't access them for some reason. There's just something with the you click on it and nothing pulls up. And I couldn't find Flatbush's either. But I found the BTA ones. So let me give you some, show you some of, hold on a second, just so you get a sense of what Orthodoxy used to be like. I didn't go through all of them to see how far this goes. That is when they stopped it. But here is the BTA, the Girls Central 1955 yearbook. Let me go down a little bit here. Oops, hold on a second. So you have the twirling also. And here's the cheerleading squad. Okay, you see the skirt's a little short maybe, but that's 55. Here you have 1969. They have not only they have cheerleaders, they have boosters, and they would come to the games. Here I found this is 1962, where you have, I don't know the difference in a booster and a cheerleader, but here you have there's the cheerleading squad. And on the upper left is the booster squad. I don't know the difference. If you go through these yearbooks, there might even be people listening to us now who are in these pictures. And then the last one, 1965, here's the cheerleading squad. And if you think it's finished, it's not, because I don't feel comfortable showing a page like on a Facebook. I don't have Facebook, but if you search, sometimes it comes up from contemporary students. But I just Googled it, Yeshiva League Girls Cheerleaders, and lo and behold, a couple of years ago, at one of the playoff games, one of the groups, they came. It was just the girls. It wasn't organized, but they themselves came with their pom-poms and everything. And so that's cheerleading. Finally, two more things. Rabbi Ari Kahn sent me this. He found it. There's a Hebrew plaque as well, also at Bar Ilan, in honor of by the Beit Midrash or the building inside. I'm not sure. I think it's by Beit Midrash. I showed you last week in honor of Judith Lieberman, also in honor of Saul Lieberman. That's the Beit Midrash Gavoa. And finally, last thing, this came in the mail. Recently, I'm not a subscriber, but I bought it for the University of Scranton Library. In fact, there's an article here by one of the people who's on with us almost every week. But it's devoted to Rabbi Lamb. And what I found really interesting, relevant to the things we've been discussing about, is Jonathan Sorna's art. What they did is each person analyzed an article of Norman Lamb. And he wrote so many, so there's a lot to analyze. Jonathan Sorna looked at this article that appeared in 1959, I think it was in Jewish Life, about mixed seating and separate seating. That I'll tell you exactly where it is. He'll tell us it was 1959. No, this was in tradition, actually. 1959, he just had come. I think he came in 58 to Jewish Center from Springfield. I made a mistake last class. I said his article on the Ketubah when he was still in Springfield. He might have written it in Springfield, but didn't appear to 59, fall of 59. So he had left Springfield. So but he's still a young rabbi, 31 years old. So this is an article about mixed seating. And this is the second article that Sarna wrote. Sarna also wrote a comprehensive article on it. And what I find particularly of interest is on page 229, Norman Lamb picks up with the whole Christianization idea. And he actually rejects Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik had talked about Christianization, that the Christians at the beginning instituted this mixed seating. And what Norman Lamb points out is actually it was a pagan idea, which only later comes into the church. But he wrote a letter to Marvin Fox. He was good friends with Marvin Fox, who I knew from Brandeis. Marvin Fox is also one of the founders of tradition. And he said to him that he revised the Christianization idea to show, this time with documentation, unlike JB, that it is originally a pagan institution. Why I think this is so interesting, because usually we think of JB, we think of like the Haredim who don't want to respect the Rav. Norman Lamb was a Talmud Muvhak of Rav Soloveitchik. He's the only person to get a PhD directed by Rabbi Soloveitchik, in addition to getting smicha. And yet we see that in a private letter, someone asked about private letters a few weeks ago, but in a private letter, which he sent to Marvin Fox, he refers to the Rav as JB, which today I don't think people would in a private letter. It just shows you that private letters are different. And when people speak, it doesn't mean he had less respect, but there was a way of speaking in private. There was, you could refer to him, I guess, that way. He never would write that way in a published thing, but it just shows you, Marvin Fox didn't go to YU. He's a Skokie graduate, or Chicago, it was Chicago then. But still, it shows how there was a different sense, I guess. And I wish Rabbi Lamb was around and I could ask him, you know, about that. Thank you all for indulging me. And now let's pick up. Get my stuff here. Very good. Okay, well, we're in the middle. We stopped at right in the middle of Meshulam Roth blasting the Rav. We're going to, the best thing is Shaul Lieberman. And we'll finish up with that and move on. But if you recall, Shaul Lieberman was going to be given the prize, the Rav Kook Prize for his Tosefta Kefshuta, his great work. And Rav Meshulam Roth was also supposed to be given for his responsa, Kol Mevaser. And he refuses and goes into great detail as to why he can't receive it together with Lieberman. He mentioned all the prohibitions Lieberman's violating. He's, as I said, I think this is the last thing I said last class, he's training reform rabbis. He calls conservative reform. And this is transgressing the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says, especially Choshe Mishpat, Pereches, Halacha Aleph, whoever appoints to the office a judge who is unfit for it, or one whose knowledge of the Torah is inadequate, though the latter is otherwise a lovable person possessing admirable qualities, whoever makes such an appointment transgresses a negative commandment. So he's saying Shaul Lieberman, by being involved with people getting smicha and observing movement, you're violating this explicit halacha. He continues. He mentions how in Masachet Gittin, page 62, it says that you have people who plow the lands during the sabbatical year. That's a sin. You're not allowed to do it in the sabbatical year. You're not allowed to assist them in any way to enable them to violate this. And so that shows that that's always cited as a source, that you can't be over there. You can't assist those who are sinning. And he says, all the more so, to give a prize to a teacher at a reform rabbinical seminary. Therefore, Meshulam concludes, Orthodox rabbis must avoid receiving an award with him as a protest against this decision, so that their participating is not agreement and acknowledgement. Well, oh, then we saw Chaim Leshem. He says that, wait a second, we have a tshuva of Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, the great Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, who says that you could teach Karaites Torah, because maybe you can bring them back. And then why can't you teach in a conservative institution? Rabbi Roth says, the way he understands the Mizrahi is that until the Karaites agree to, let's say, follow basic rabbinite, that's what it's called, Karaites and rabbinite laws, that is to observe the holidays the way they're supposed to, and not to mock the rabbis, which they used to do, then and only then can you teach them. But you can't teach them if they're still, if they're not open to changing and if they haven't accepted certain basic things. Second of all, Rav Roth says that the Karaites have the status of a Tinuk Shenishma. Already the Rambam mentions this, that the Karaites don't know any better. They were brought up this way. That's what they were taught. And he says this does not apply to those planning to become, quote, reform rabbis. I don't know why it doesn't apply. They grew up. Some of them it doesn't. Some of them we know transferred from Yeshiva College, but for many it does apply. So, he also says that it's one thing to teach Karaites on an occasional basis. He says, that's what the Mizrahi, I think if you look in the Mizrahi, you don't see him say that. But he says, the Mizrahi says it's only occasionally, but a permanent position, that he says, even Mizrahi would oppose. Now, among those, while this was going on, who expressed approval for Ramashulam's opinion was none other than Ramordechai Gifter. Many of us know the name, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Telz Yeshiva in Cleveland. A graduate of Yeshiva Rav Yitzchak Hanan, I'll speak about this in a minute, but which together with Beis Medrash Gavoha, it's spelled, I said this before, G-O-V-O-H-A, but that's a mistake. It should be Gavoha, not Gavoha. But okay, Ashkenazim don't know that much about TikTok. Those two yeshivas, Lakewood and Telz, were always regarded as the most conservative, with a small c, of the yeshivas. I remember Rabbi Teitz, now he's the old Rabbi Teitz, Rabbi Lezer Meir Teitz, telling me that's the reason he never got a bachelor. He's a PhD in math. He taught at Rutgers also. He said he didn't get a bachelor's because he was at Telz. I don't know what he had to do to go to get the PhD. But so this was always a very conservative yeshiva, Telz. And there's all sorts of stories about Rabbi Gifter really became anti-YU, very much so, even though he went to Yeshiva Sefer Yitzchak Hanan. I heard from someone, he's no longer alive, he went to Telz. A lot of people went to Telz who were not really Haredi. They went to Telz because they lived in Cleveland and they didn't want to send their kids. That was the yeshiva. They didn't have a modern Orthodox yeshiva and they didn't want to have them dorm. So he told me the following story, that when he was finishing high school, he was going to go to YU. And Rabbi Gifter called his mother in. He didn't say his father. I don't know. Well, he said his mother, to try to convince them not to send him to YU. And Rabbi Gifter said, if you send him to YU, I tell you within 6 months, he'll be eating tarfus. And this is what he told me, this person. He said, my mother said to Rabbi Gifter, I want my money back for the 4 years I sent him to school here. And Rabbi Gifter didn't understand. He said, why would you want your money back? He said, because if you tell me that 4 years of Telz Yeshiva and within just a few months at YU, he throws it all away, then the chinuch he got here is not such a good chinuch. That's what he told me. But it was considered somewhat extreme. And he comes out publicly defending Rav Meshulam Roth, who, because there are many Orthodox who thought that this was going way overboard. They had respect for Lieberman, even if they disagreed with his decision. After all, you could disagree with his decision, but he wasn't being given an award for that. He was given an award for the Tosefta Kivshuta, which is a great work. But Rabbi Gifter writes that from the time Lieberman joined the seminary, he was no longer in the good graces of the Gedolim. You can't consider him as part of, you know, part and parcel of the Gedolim. And he says, now matters are even worse. It was bad enough when he first went there because he continues to be associated. Even when the movement, we see clearly they want to uproot the fundamentals of the faith. And Rabbi Gifter says his involvement with the movement is as its chief rabbi. The replacement of his predecessor, Rabbi Levi Ginsberg. Is it any wonder, he continues, that Meshulam Roth found that it was forbidden to participate together and get a prize together with the chief rabbi of the conservatives? So that's how Rabbi Gifter categorizes him, chief rabbi of the conservatives. And I understand why he would say that. Even if I disagree with the evaluation, he is in charge. You know, he's the man in charge, the rector. He's signing the smichas. So there's definitely what to say there in terms of criticism. What I want to point out to you, though, is that while people who know about Rav Gifter's career, they'll hear this and they'll say, well, this is in line with what we've always known. It's not in line with actually how he was maybe 15 years before that. By the way, in terms of being in line with what we'd expect, there's another letter. If you look at this, is published in Yeshurin, the journal. I shouldn't call it a journal. It comes out like twice a year. It's like 1,000 pages. These new annuals, they try to be as big as they can. If you look in there, there's a letter right after that from 1964. And it's criticism of an Orthodox rabbi who signed a joint letter with conservative and reform rabbis about the importance of bris milah. Rabbi Gifter rebukes this rabbi for signing such a letter. The rabbi thought, we can all agree that bris milah is important, circumcision. So, it's not like the Orthodox rabbi needs to remind his congregants, but the Reform rabbi would. But the signing letter talking about how important bris milah is, he signed it with them. What could be, I know the rabbi's thinking, what could be controversial about that? But Rabbi Gifter says that the implicit recognition of the non-Orthodox rabbis, as you're signing it together with different rabbis, this is what makes the signing such a mistake. And he further expresses agreement with an unnamed Gadol, I don't tell us who it is, who said, better that bris milah be done away with than that Orthodox rabbis join with non-Orthodox clergy. Now, that to me strikes me as a bit extreme. Better than bris milah be done away with. But he would say that it creates a whole ziyufa Torah, which is against everything. I've noticed recently that even some of the right-wing rabbis have been signing letters like against anti-Semitism together with non-Orthodox rabbis, and they're all identified as rabbis. So it could be there's a change. By the way, even as moderate a figure as Rabbi Eliezer Silver declared that he also would never sign a public declaration of any form with a non-Orthodox rabbi. If in Gastwirth's book, Fraud, Corruption, and Holiness, all about the kashrus corruption and the kashrus scandals and everything, on pages 166 and 167, it talks about how the OU, to work for kashrus, the OU agreed to work together with the Conservative Rabbinical Assembly in the United Synagogue. What's the, I guess from the OU's perspective, this is for all of Klal Yisrael. But then you can read on how the Agudas Rabbani went crazy about this. Within a few days, Rabbi Joseph Konvitz was a Rav in Newark, very close to where I am now, the son-in-law of the Ridbaz. We've had classes on the Ridbaz. The father of Milton Konvitz, professor at Cornell. Milton Konvitz is the recipient of the Rav's English letter, Tshuva. Not so short, a few pages, about the Interfaith Chapel at Cornell, where the Rav explains his position. That I have to ask Natty Hafka where he found that. Everyone knew that this existed for years, and I always tried to find it, and I couldn't find it, and Natty got it. By the way, I do have letters. I have about 15 letters of the Rav. Maybe next class I'll show you some of the things they say in them, but I'm going to publish them. But Rabbi Konvitz declared that since the OU was willing to work with the conservative Jews in the Kashrut Association, his group was withdrawing even nominal affiliation with it on all questions of Kashrut. The Agudas Rabbanim would refuse to accept responsibility for any decisions of the OU. So once again, you see that the Agudas Rabbanim saying that the OU is not religious enough. Wait till you see my new blog post, which I just sent in today, and wait till you hear about the Agudas Rabbanim and the OK. The Agudas Rabbanim comes out with a statement, and for good reason, as you'll see, that you cannot trust the OK, that it's so the machlokas between the Agudas Rabbanim and the other kashrus organizations, that was really something. But Rabbi Soloveitchik had a different approach. As Seth Farber has shown, in an article, I don't think he includes this in the book, but he has an article on all about, it's called Reproach, Recognition, and Respect, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik and Orthodoxy's Mid-Century Attitude Towards Non-Orthodox Denominations in the Journal of American Jewish History. He talks about how in 1937, the Rav spearheaded a public relations campaign for kashrus observance, and you know who's one of his co-sponsors? None other than Rabbi Louis Epstein of Kehilath Israel, the book of which I just showed you. So the Rav didn't see a problem with this. But I do have to point out that Rabbi Gifter's position, which I just mentioned, it's not complete without mentioning that in his earlier years, 15 years before, let's say, no more. This is 20 some years before, he had a more liberal stand. When he was a young rabbi in Waterbury, Connecticut, he had no compunctions about writing lengthy Torah letters to none other than Louis Ginsberg. Louis Ginsberg was a Telzer, by the way. He learned in Telz, so they had this connection. These letters, you can find them. Of course, I have copies. They're found in the archive of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. I will show you just one of them right now. Here is one. And you can see he addresses, this is from 1944. He addresses him, Kvod Harav Rav Levi Ginsberg Shlita. It's not Harav Hagon, anything like that. In other letters, he addresses him as like Kvod Rav Levi Professor Ginsberg, that sort of thing. He doesn't address it with the terms used for the Gedolim, But he and but he goes on for pages and pages of Ha'aros. In one of his letters, he says that your Sefer, this is in Ginsburg's Perushim v'Chidushim on the Yerushalmi Brachos, I showed you. He says, it kept me up all night. I couldn't go to sleep. I was so, here's just one page. And there are many pages because he has a number of letters. You do find, by the way, rabbis who do address Ginsburg as if he was a traditional Godel B'Yisrael. Rav Chaim Ozer addresses him that way. But Rav Chaim Ozer was a relative of his, a cousin of his wife, actually. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Nachum Kirschbaum, I have a whole list, Rav Yitzchak of Weinberg, Rav Kasher, Rav Shlomo Gorin. They address him in a way as if they're addressing a colleague. Now, since we're talking a bit about Rav Gifter, I want to show you, though, something from his earlier years, which maybe wasn't so moderate. He has... here, hold on a second. I'm going to have to, I'll pull it up on the screen right now for you, because I think you're going to want to see this. So I'll show it to you. I forgot to pull it up before, but now I have it. So I'm going to give it to you. It's amazing that this was published in the Rav Gifter's Rebbe at YU was named Rav Moshe Aaron Paleyev. The many descendants of Rav Moshe Aaron Paleyev. I have one who lives in my town, West Orange, the son of Rabbi Paleyev's son, who had a son who was a rabbi in the Newark area, but many descendants. And Rabbi Gifter, when he went to Tells, he had the long correspondence, Torah matters, but not just Torah matters. They shoot the breeze. They talk about everything. This is what Rabbi Gifter writes in, this would be in the, I forget, I don't have the date here. In the late 20s, it would be. You know what, rather than, I hate having to correct myself later, so I can tell you right now, I don't need to worry about what year it is. I'll pull it up right now. They published a few of the books. One of the books is his correspondence with Rabbi Yehuda Leib Forer. I've mentioned it before. The rabbi in Holyoke, Massachusetts, a student of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who ended up here. Very interesting because he was rabbi at the same time of the Orthodox and the Conservative Shul in Holyoke, Massachusetts. Okay, I found a letter. It's 1935. So in this letter, this is what Rabbi Gifter, writing from Tells, he's writing to Rabbi Paleyev, and he says as follows. He says, I'll just read you, see where my marker is, fourth line down. I've already written to you that I can't describe in speech and in writing the feelings that fill me regarding Tells. He was so excited about the learning there. How great is my zechut that I was able to come here. And those bachurim, you know, the talented students who are still at Yeshiva College, at Institute of America, it's as if they're, you know, they're mason because they don't know what, do they really know what true learning is? Do they know what our, you know, the greatness of Torah learning is? He says, you should, lishtadel bazeh, Rabbi Paleyev, you should involve yourself in this. He's talking about the Al Kamosu. He's talking about one person in particular, him and others. That you should encourage them. They should come learn and tells. The Ein Lo Male Ra Meha Admon Hayoshevo Bushkato. You shouldn't be concerned about the red one, the redhead, who sits in his office, and he grabs in his net, the net of the college, his college. Pure souls, nefashos taros, and destroys them on the altar of kefir and apikorsis. So who's he talking about? Who's the red one? The red one is none other than Revel. He was a redhead. He had a red beard. They used to call him, his enemies called him the Reiterhund, the Red Dog, the ones who hated them. But it's quite shocking that he's writing this way about Rabbi Raphael, who, after all, was the Rosh Yeshiva. Not just he wasn't just an administrator or a president. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, and he was a recognized Ivoli, and he was also a Telzer. He had been a Telz. I think the people who published it, they might not have known who it was, or maybe they didn't know, and they did it anyway. Sometimes people don't know. So, for instance, they published, I have this book. I've been reading this book recently because of American Orthodoxy. Very interesting. He's like a Satmar who wrote it, but all about Rav Yaakov Yosef. But there's they've been publishing the stuff of the Aderis recently, the Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Talmid, the father-in-law of Rav Kook from the first marriage. And he is not one to hold his punches. He has an autobiography, which you've got to see what he says about some of the Gedolim. All these people write autobiographies are unusual. But he has a letter where he blasts this rabbi. Really harsh. The people who published it, I'm sure they didn't realize he's speaking about none other than Rav Yaakov Yosef. And the things he says about Rav Yaakov Yosef is just, I think if they knew who he was talking about, they probably thought he was speaking about some phony. They didn't realize it was Yaakov Yosef. They wouldn't have included it. But that's what Rabbi Gifter says. And I'll tell you one more thing, that in this very book, hold on, let me share my screen with you again. Hold on. You have Rabbi, do I have it here? Yes. You have Rabbi Poleyov on page, oh no, that's what I just showed you. Okay, well, I'll tell you outside. On page 262, Rabbi Poleyov writes to Rabbi Gifter that the Telz Association, in New York, there's a Telz Association, they made they're having a big, an event, and they made a big deal about Ginsburg, speaking about all the great, they had a thing of all the people, you know, the great people who've come out of Telz, and they included Ginsburg as one of them. Rabbi Poleyov is saying, I don't understand how you can include Louis Ginsburg as one of the great products of Telz. He's left the Orthodox world. There you go. Okay, let me just return to briefly to the attack of Rabbi Meshulam Roth against Lieberman. As could be expected, and I mentioned, it created a lot of discussion, and members of the Orthodox world stood leading figures either with Lieberman or against Lieberman. There is something strange about the whole event, though, which I point out in my Lieberman Kuntress, is that, and this is only made apparent when the second volume of Roth's volume Kol Mevaser appears, because in there he has a very respectful letter addressed to a man named Adolf, that's his Hebrew name, Aryeh Schwartz, because he published an edition of the Tosefta Baba Kama with his notes. Lieberman says in the introduction to Tosefta Peshuta that this book only has bibliographical value. It has no substantive value. But Rav Meshulam Roth sends him a letter with notes, a very friendly letter. Who is Adolf Schwartz? Adolf Schwartz was the head of the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, a Talmud Muvhak of Zachariah Frankel. Adolf Schwartz served in a synagogue that had an organ. And the Rabbinical Seminary in Vienna was not an Orthodox institution. Here, Rav Meshulam Roth is relating in such a positive way to Adolf Schwartz. So then what's the difference between him and Lieberman? I think the answer is that Rav Meshulam Roth was in Vienna around right after World War I, even during World War I, and he knew Schwartz. He knew him personally. So since he knew him personally, he knew that even though he was not an Orthodox person, he nevertheless was a Shomer Torah mitzvos, and he could write to him positively. The reason he took the shul with the organ is because Frankel told him to. Now, Frankel was a big opponent of organs, but Frankel, just like you had Orthodox rabbis telling their students to take synagogues, not machitzas, Frankel said, you have to take the synagogue with the organ. It's better you take it than someone else. You'll keep it from going really reform. I like to think that if Meshulam Roth had known Shaul Lieberman, he would have related him the same way he related to Adolf Schwartz. It's also interesting that Rav Meshulam makes no distinction between conservative and reform. He clearly didn't understand the subtleties of American religious life. Poskim who lived in the United States, even those who were strong opponents of conservative Judaism, regarded as real heresy, Tycho Kadiris Moshe, other sources, they all recognize it's not identical with reform. and there's completely different questions. When Moshe Feinstein deals with an issue of reform, there's not even a question about marriage, divorce, not, but with when he deals with the conservative, you have to determine, you know, because it could be a Shomer Shabbos, it could be a religious person just doing it for Parnassa. So it's really very different. But you can have again and again examples of where you don't see this distinction. I found that the stipler, Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, writes that you shouldn't learn from Lieberman's Yerushalmi Kifshuto, since after writing the book, he went to the United States and worked with the Reform. What do you mean, work with the Reform? You work with a conservative. But for the stipler, if you're not with the Orthodox, you're with the Reform. The Chiddush of that letter of the stipler is that he's saying that even a work written before Lieberman went to work with the conservative is still off limits. And you can ask about this. Sefer Torah Shekosav Min, let's say, it's only after he's a Min. If he becomes a Min, you don't say that about the Sefer Torah before. But that was the Sipor's position. And there's many examples you can find of this. In my little book, I quoted an example that when Professor Yitzhak Gilat took the steps to help bring about the Institute for Advanced Torah Studies that Lieberman was so involved with, he was attacked for wanting to create a rabbinical seminary in Hamodia, which is the Aguda paper he was compared to, Sons, Geiger, Buber, and Lieberman. Just look at who Lieberman's being put with. For Professor Gilat, who I knew a bit, to be compared to Lieberman, he would be the first one to say, Chas v'sholom, I don't touch his fingernails. But I'm not... to be compared to Lieberman, he'd be very happy. But look who Lieberman is being put with. Sons, Geiger, Buber, not a Shomer Shabbos among the bunch. And Geiger's a Talmud Chacham, but still wasn't at all religious. I shouldn't say that. He was religious like in a reform way, but he was completely anti-halachic. But just look at the company that Lieberman was placed in, and you can see how far his reputation had fallen with the right-wing Orthodox. In the midst of the controversy swirling around him, which was the talk of the town, Lieberman announces he's not going to accept the prize. I published his letter, which I found in the archives, a copy of the letter in the Lieberman archives at the seminary. I don't know why certain things were kept and others weren't. Lieberman wrote many letters, which he doesn't have copies. He made copies of certain letters, and he kept them. The mayor's name was Chaim Levanon, and he writes to him. He says as follows. It's very unpleasant for me to see the name of Rav Kook being dragged into this dispute. He says that if they had consulted with me first, I would refuse to get involved with this issue because of what I need the kavod. He says the prize money I'm not going to take anyway. And what's the kavod? It says kavod better than other people get the kavod more than me. He says I haven't spoken up until now. I haven't said anything because he acknowledges me. He says shemesh shachatz because a bit of pride. He doesn't want to give it up. And he didn't want people to say that I don't treat Rav Kook with respect, you know, if I'm refusing to get a prize about Rav Kook. But he says, and also he didn't want to show disrespect to the judges. But now that the rabbis who are opposing me, they're allowing me now that I can do the right thing and I can say I don't need the prize. And everyone will know that the reason I'm not taking the prize is not because I don't respect the judges, but I want to be bricha min machokas. I want run away from disputes. So he withdrew from it. Well, in order to atone, in quotes, for how Lieberman is treated, the very next year the municipality of Tel Aviv decides to give him the Bialik Prize, and that's a more prestigious prize than the Rav Kook Prize. But although he accepts the prize. He doesn't accept the prize. He accepts the prize, but he says as follows. Very interesting, because you see here his ambivalent feelings about receiving this prize. He writes this to Mr. Ben Yishai. I don't know who this was. He says, I received your letters. Thank you very much. He says, I want to speak, though, about, he actually doesn't say, I thank you for what you told me, but I want to speak a little bit about myself. He says, I'm not here to criticize or to praise prizes. He says, you can have two approaches. There's good, Panim al Kan al Khan. He says, prizes are good in that they could encourage young people who are involved in Chachma and Mada. And it's a, he calls it, it's an Mishum Idulutz Irim. If you have prizes, that it encourages the young people who are involved in scholarship. And however, he says, there's a Ksat Tam with Gam. Listen to this. He says, there's a problem also with giving prizes for people doing Torah. He says, it's one thing if you're doing Chachma and Mada. He says, but to give a prize for someone involved in Torah, Shehi Mechayevet Sniut Mitchilat Priyatava, Pumbi or Kashla Yotar Mina. He says that Torah learning is not supposed to get prizes for that. V'chilo Dayam Lehem with Vnei Torah. Isn't it enough for the Bnei Torah? Shetimu Lehem Be'olam Hazeh Me'enol Haba. Isn't it enough that they're learning Torah? Which is like Olam Haba. So here you see Lieberman, he's writing as like a religious Jew. He's saying, I understand prizes, but the whole idea of prizes for Torah literature, it goes against the tzniut that people are supposed to, focus on Torah learning. And what do people learning Torah need prizes for? And he says, I'm writing so you understand that my situation, that they never consulted me beforehand. They did it themselves. Since they announced this without consulting me, I have no choice but to, v'varecha apras, k'shem sh'adam avarecha hara, k'shem sh'avarecha ha-torah, u'mekabo yisrim ba'ave. So I have to accept it, even though I would prefer not to do it, but they already gave it to me. And he says that also, you asked me to write about my book, he says, by the time you get this letter, it'll be too, the award will already been given out, so I don't have to do that. So you see, Lieberman doesn't need the prizes. He thinks it's a problem for prizes. The language he uses, the specific thing he says is, he says that those who study Torah, the oskim Torah, she mechayevet sniut. When you learn Torah requires you to be modest and humble and publicity, no. So it's an issue. There are prizes. We give out prizes. The truth of the matter is it's not, the prizes isn't such a big deal today. What's amazing is maybe we've reached the point where it doesn't matter because everyone knows it, but I'm not going to mention any names here. I guess if you're not going to toot your horn, others have to, but you can find all sorts of people, recognized, Talmidei Chachamim, well-known. They have websites, which obviously they put together, and you'll read stuff like Rabbi So-and-so's lectures astound audiences worldwide with a unique ability to bring together. And I don't know. I'm just so uncomfortable. How do you write that about yourself? Let someone else write it. But people produce their own websites and they're regarded saying all the sort of things that no one would ever say if they're speaking. But there doesn't seem to be any problem in writing it. And, tzniut is not just women's clothes. For the life of me, I can't understand how people can create websites, including well-known, esteemed rabbis, and talk about how their unique ability to do this and that. If you bereach mina kavod, if you run from kavod will chase after you. But whoever heard of, we have some examples. Most rabbis, they write a sefer and the title page, they just write their name. Sometimes they write Rav. We have some examples of rabbis who've created their own title pages and yet in Hebrew, and the way they describe themselves, I guess it's the same sort of thing about the website, but it bothers me, it troubles me. I was told by someone when I mentioned this once that today it's a different world. You have to say it because everyone else is saying it. So, but I don't get it. Very uncomfortable with that. Okay, let's continue. The way that we've just seen from Meshulam Roth and Rav Mordechai Gifter, the way they regarded Lieberman is nothing more than a turncoat, who you don't even have to acknowledge his Torah learning, was indeed the view of many in the Haredi world. If you look when he dies in Apartis, Hamodia, all these other places, they don't even mention it. The same Apartis who was regarding him as one of the Gedolim 40 years before, he's not mentioned. And because of this blackout, I think that the typical yeshiva person today, Haredi, Hasidic, whatever, has never even heard of Lieberman. the people who've heard of him are the elites who go, you know, really deep into matters or intellectual. Most people haven't heard of him. Tosefta Kivshuta, I've never heard of Tosefta Kivshuta. They've heard of the Chazon Yecheskel, I've heard of Yecheskel Abramsky maybe, but they never heard of the Tosefta Kivshuta. I looked in the Bar Ilan database. Now I don't use it anymore. I use Otzer Chachma, but years ago, and no mention of Tosefta Kivshuta in the traditional rabbinic work, Shelos and Shuvos. There's a number of anecdotes. I recorded some of them in my booklet, Towards Lieberman, that shows this negative attitude. I was told by Rabbi Nosson Kamenetsky, and then he published in The Making of the Gadol the following. His father, Yaakov Kamenetsky, was once at a wedding, and Lieberman was there, and they're talking. What do you do? You talk and learning. That's what these people do at weddings. And Rav Aaron Cutler came over to him. He was also at the wedding, pulled him aside and told him, can't talk to him. It's us here to talk, to look at a Russia. And as Rav Nosson had said to me, and he wrote it, his father had a different perspective on these matters and ignored Rav Aaron and continued talking to Lieberman. So here you see Rav Aaron Cutler saying, you can't even talk to him. He's a Russia. And Rivakov a different position. I have to point out something else I discovered, though, in the archives, which I included in the booklet, is that although Rav Aaron had strongly negative views of Shaul Lieberman, when he needed Lieberman's help, he asked him for it. In 1954, the Immigration and Naturalization Service requested the name of three institutions that accepted the credits of Beis Medrash Gavoa, which I'm assuming is people... immigration naturalization, people coming, let's say, from overseas to study in Lakewood, they needed some evidence that this is a real institution. Rav Aaron spoke to Lieberman about this, about helping his yeshiva. And as one who always treated the yeshivas with the greatest respect, despite the way they treated him, Lieberman followed up on Rav Aaron's request. And the seminary agreed to accept credits from... Beis Medrash Gavoa. Now, no one from Beis Medrash Gavoa is going to the seminary, but on paper, they can say that we will accept these credits. And this must have been of great assistance to them in terms of getting students from Mexico, Canada, wherever we're coming. So here you see Lieberman and Rav Aaron turning to Lieberman when he needs the help. Others in the Orthodox world, while friendly with Lieberman, were reluctant to acknowledge this publicly. These were private friendships, but not public. There is a son of a Gadol B'Yisrael, and he showed me letters that Lieberman wrote to his father. One was great. I'm looking at this letter, and I can't figure out where it's from. It's it has the date, and under the date, it has the place. Kuf Resh Mem, Kerem, and then Mem Resh Tet Hey. It was Tet, not or Tuf. I'm looking. Kerem, Marita, Merta, I don't know. Anyone know what it is? Martha's Vineyard. I'm looking at this. What is Karen Martha? Martha's Vineyard. So the Lieberman would go there sometimes. So after seeing these letters, including one letter that fits in, this is after my Lieberman booklet, but it fits in very well because Lieberman, see, this Gadol had asked him what the Gadol's name's initials are MS, but if you want to figure it out. This Gadol had asked him, you know, what's the story in Jerusalem? How do they treat you? And he wrote back that the Gadolim treat me well, the Ketanim, they're the ones who don't treat me so well. And it's true that he never became persona non grata. He would sit right next to the Brisker Rav and other Gadolim. So after seeing these letters, I said, oh, can I have copies? He said, no, I can't give you copies, you know, because he doesn't want the world to know that. In the Lieberman archive, you have the letters of this Gadol to Lieberman. What I was interested, though, was the letters of Lieberman to him. That's of interest, to me at least. But many were like this. They would cite his position. I even showed in my Lieberman booklet a Satmar Chassid, name is Shamaria Grunbaum, still alive. He publishes a letter from Lieberman in one of his works, but he doesn't cite Lieberman by name. He's Chacham Echad. I found out about this, believe it or not, Professor Halivni. I don't know how Professor Halivni knew about this. He didn't spend his time reading recent Satmar books. But he told me, look at this. He said, it's there. Maybe someone showed him. He had connections in that world. A family, you know, well, I don't know so much family, but extended family. But he told me. And I looked for it. He didn't know where. He just said, looked in this Grimbaum book, and I found it. Now, the identity is only slightly veiled, because in the letter, Lieberman refers to his book, Yerushalmi Kivshuto. Maybe Grimbaum didn't think people would even know what that is. But I guess people in the know would know who he's corresponding with. I can't tell you how many people from like Satmar have been shocked by this and wrote to me about what I put in there. I think it's Mischief by Grimbaum. He wants those in the know to recognize it, so he includes it. Incidentally, yeah, I know Halivni came from Siget, but I don't know in terms of the... Even in terms of extended family, I don't know if he had anything. He doesn't speak in his book about having any real family. Yes, of course, it came from that world. So, but he must have had friends and people. In terms of his learning, the last time, he's not well, but the last time I saw Halivni was maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, maybe more, at the Jewish National Library. And it was quite surprising to me, because we always spoke. One day, I could tell stories about me and Halivni. I never was a student, but I was like a quasi-student, because whenever we saw each other, we spoke for hours sometimes. We could speak for hours, I should say. But he didn't whisper as he got older. And if you know the reading room there, but with him, no one could tell him to be quiet. But am I telling you this? Because I got there when it opened, I don't know what time, 8:30, whatever time it opens in the morning. He was there, and I left like 5 o'clock. It's the last time I saw him, and he was still there. He's sitting at his desk, on his table there. All he has, and this is the entire day, is a Gemara and a Didrukei Sofrim. He spent the entire day with the Gemara and the Didrukei Sofrim. No Rishonim, nothing, just learning Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos. I'm thinking the only when he goes home, he's writing at night. But this is during the daytime. No Rishonim, no books, just sitting there the whole day with the Gemara. Getting back to the story, if you look at Lieberman and the Orthodox, I give a number of other examples of this, where you take Shaul Lieberman's Torah and you attribute it to a Chacham Echad, things like that. Others, however, have a different approach. So, for example, you look at Rav Zevin's book. Rav Zevin was very close to Shaul Lieberman. When Shaul Lieberman came to Israel, Rav Zevin, of course, could appreciate real learning. It's famous that when Shaul Lieberman, he would go to Rav Zevin. He said he always would visit Rav Zevin. He didn't want Rav Zevin to come to visit him, because he said, Rav Zevin's a chassid. He likes to schmooze. If I go there, when we're done talking what I want to talk about, I can leave. But if he comes to my house, I can't tell him to leave when enough's enough. Rav Zevin would always refer to him as Rav Shaul Lieberman. And he refers in his books, Modi Mahacha, all rabbis, just with the Reish. If you look in the Art Scroll, in some of the volumes, they have two different translators, but in two of the translations of Modi Mahalacha, whereas Rav Zevin refers to him as Rabbi Shaul Lieberman, the translators take out the R. We already know from previous classes they did a lot worse to Modim HaLacha. But this is just wrong. If Rabbi Zevin calls him Rabbi in one of the three volumes, and obviously had a different editor, they leave it in, but not the others. In fact, I think in the other one where they leave it in, they didn't know who he is, whoever the translator was, the editor. Why do I say this? Because they spell the name L-I-B-E-R-M-A-N, Lieberman. So it's, you know, Rabbi... You know, they don't know how to spell Lieberman. The other two volumes spell it right, but they take out the R. Even in Art Scrolls Mishnayos, though, Mishnayos Trumos, believe it or not, one of the sources is listed as Tosefta Kivshuta. So you have a different approaches in the Orthodox. Rav Chaim Rappaport told me that he once visited the Institute for Study of the Jerusalem Talmud. The Gera Hasidim have established a Daf Yomi of the Jerusalem Talmud. Ger, if you've been following it, now it's the huge dispute, because the Ger Rebbe who broke away, Rav Shaul Alter, he came to America last week, and he's getting huge crowds, tens of thousands of people. If the real Ger Rebbe came to America, he wouldn't get crowds like this. And if you know that what's going on, this is like one of the biggest machlokes, and you've had, this is much worse than what we had in Satmar and in some of the others. Anyone in the Ger Hasidic group who shows any respect to this Rebbe, who goes to listen to him, you know, has any involvement, marries with someone who's involved, you're out. You're completely thrown out. And one of the reasons for the break in Ger Hasidus is because Ger Hasidim today do not really believe in serious learning. There's no Rishonim, there's no Lumdus, it's just Gemara Rashi. Is it even Tosfos? I don't know. Except for the elites, it's just basic, simple learning. They've gotten rid of serious learning, and this from a Hasidus that produced the Sfas Emes and all these other things. So you have a huge break going on with Ger. And also, Ger has all these crazy rules. I don't know if you know these rules. I mean, forget it. I'm not just referring to the extreme Tznius rules, but all sorts of cult-like rules that maybe I can read some of you. You'd be shocked that this is this actually goes on. I have family in Ger, in Gur. You don't speak about these matters with them, but the way you have to, the rules about how you live, especially how you, when you're with your wife, how you're supposed to behave, how boys are supposed to be when they're in yeshiva, all sorts of unbelievably strange stuff. So Rav Shaul Alter is not into any of this stuff. And he's not just a goon, he's a bucky in everything. If you look in Professor Spiegel, Yaakov Moshe Spiegel, who's written so much on rabbinic literature, he often thanks Rabbi Shaul Alter, because he would read his articles ahead of time. I can tell you now that he's a Rebbe, he doesn't have time to be reading academic articles. But the Ger Hasidim, when they still were interested in learning, maybe they started the Daf Yomi and Yerushalmi. And they have a whole institute. So Rabbi Chaim Rappaport asked them when he visited, do they use Yerushalmi Kivshuto and Tosefta Kivshuto? And they showed him, they have it on the desk. And they even use his other writings, they said. But they also said they never would mention Lieberman by name. Instead, they would quote an interpretation and say, it's possible to say. This is because, as they put it to him, and he told me, we want people to use a Yerushalmi. If you, the Yerushalmi they put out, if you mention Lieberman, no one's going to buy it. What we're going to do next class, just to set it up, I want to first just talk a little bit about the halacha justification, because that you do find sources in the Gemara Rishonim that you... For the blackout, I should say, of Lieberman. Use his Torah, but don't mention him. And but then I want to move into some more some other events as we move on. The seminary fire, Dr. Belkin, the Rav, the so-called joint Beit Din with the seminary and YU and RCA, which was not a joint Beit Din. It never was going to be a joint Beit Din. This is one of the big misinterpretations. And... yeah, we still have a few more classes. And of course, I do want to have some time to analyze not just the Sefer Shuta, Hellenism and Jewish Palestine, his works. And as I've said before, then we're going to have to bring it all to a close, because if you saw today what was in the news about two seminary rabbis, their wedding, someone emailed me, what would Lieberman say about this? But we'll leave that. We'll leave that because we have a lot to... still get to. Let me take the questions, the comments. Thank you all for coming out tonight. Susanna says very few partnership minion did that. Mine is trouble getting 10 men. Yeah, I think, and he told me they had to stop this. It's look, we have trouble in my minion getting 10 men also. But if you, yeah, Baruch says it's not the oldest girl yeshiva in the United States. That was Shalamis. I thought Shalamis was. But I was looking online to find its date of establishment, and someone wrote that it's the oldest girls yeshiva high school. That's what I meant. Not an elementary school. Shalamis was began as an elementary school, maybe. That's what I meant. I don't know. Baruch says maybe they went to girls' sports games. No, they went to boys' games. Ramaz is a co-ed school. Flatbush is a co-ed school. And as we saw, they went to BTA and YU. By the way, it doesn't matter if they only went to girls' games anyway, because the girls' games have the men in attendance, all the parents and everything. Yes, not all schools attendance. I'm not saying all schools, but I can tell you that Gurak testifies that Chaim Berlin joined the league at the time when they would play places like Ramaz where they did have it. Rabbi Kelman says, Rabbi Roth likely disagrees with the Chazon Ish, who claims that nowadays, as most Jews are not observant, that even though those who grew up in observant homes will leave observance, we cannot apply all the negative statements to Halachot against heretics. It seems that he does disagree, and many disagree. There's a whole movement in Israel, which in opposition to the Chazon Ish's position. I have a whole list of sources of recent figures, more recent than Rosh Hashanah, I'm talking about like in the last 20 years, who reject this idea of Tinok Shenishva. And by the way, many in the non-Orthodox world also reject the Chazon Ish, because the Chazon Ish's position is very paternalistic. What he's saying is that these people don't know any better. And they want to say, no, we know exactly what we're doing. We know what Orthodoxy is. We reject it, either for intellectual reasons or moral reasons. And there's a real sense of paternalism here in the Chazon Ish, just declaring them that we understand why he was doing this. Rav Kook does the exact same thing, though. Rav Kook says that the heretics today are what we call their force, their own sin, because the general Weltanschauung of the world, the environment, it forces them to adopt these heretical ideas. But again, that's not giving people autonomy. It's for their position. So we could see why non-Orthodox wouldn't be too crazy about that either. Someone mentions, this is Rabbi Kelman, that Rav Elyomer Bloch was much more open. His great letter defending the Neshe Tells, joining with Mizrahi and celebrating Yom HaTzma'ut. With that, he was more open. I don't know in terms of college or anything like that. I don't think so. I know that Rabbi Volk from YU came from Tells, and he had very negative things about Tells. He would say, he would refer to the real Tells, not the Tells they have in Cleveland. redheads, yes. So Rabbi Revel is a redhead. I find it sad, someone mentions, that Rabbi Gifter, who was a Talmud Chacham, but Reitz and his uncle, Rabbi Dr. Samuel Sar, Manala Reitz, were major influences on younger Mordechai. Rabbi Sar persuaded his sister to send one of her children, Max Mordechai, to come to Reitz. It's Rabbi Gifter never stopped with his respect for Moshe Soloveitchik and the learning he got at Reitz. He's not like some of them, who when they left Reitz, it's as if you didn't know they went to Reitz and you never heard about it. Rabbi Shiner, who recently passed away, he was at Reitz. I don't know if it was ever mentioned in any of the eulogies at all, none of them that I saw. Rabbi Gifter never denied it. Not only that, he participated in the Sefer Yovel, the first Sefer Yovel put up by the students for Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he has a little introduction there talking about, when the Rav gave this, I think the first year at Reitz, how much pride his father had. That was the book that Rav Shach went crazy about, asking how can the Rosh Yeshiva in America give kavod to the Rav. So Rabbi Gifter, his problem was, we see it already with Revel. He had a problem with the college. And Kal v'chomer, when he would go after Lamb and attack everything that went on in later times, so he liked the yeshiva. He had no problem with that. But I have to say, Rabbi Gifter, he was very nice to me, and I'm appreciative and I'm very grateful. And I should put this on the record. I have already put it on the record, but we have new people listening. I'll put it on the record again. If you look in the Kisrei Bechiyak of Weinberg, there's letters from Rabbi Gifter there, and for one of the most interesting letters I have from Rabbi Weinberg dealing with the Brisker method is sent to Dil Rechaim Soloveitchik is to Rabbi Gifter. Rabbi Gifter sent me copies of his letters that he received from Rechiyak of Weinberg. He knew I wasn't Yeshivalite. He took the trouble himself to make the copies, or maybe gave it to someone, but he had to find them. They're in his files. People like Rabbi Gifter are very busy. All the other Rosh Yeshiva I've asked, almost all of them have said to me, oh, I'd love to give it to you, but I don't know where they are. It's too difficult. I don't have the time. Come back to me in 6 months. And then, of course, you never get it. My Gifter, with all his busy work and things he was doing, he took the time to go through his files, to find the letters, to send them to me, to wish me the best and tell me how happy he was that I was doing this. And that, to me, I'll always remember that. And some of the things he said, which I'm not crazy about, I have to remember that for someone who wasn't in his world, and he knew I wasn't in his world, that what he did for me, he did a tova, a real favor for me, and I'm very grateful for him. Yes, so Alei Zayis points out something that was pointed out to me also, that there is this concept, Rabbi Oretz, from by Lakewood, published an article some years ago in which he cited sources that said that you can praise yourself. And they quote, they learned it out from a Gemara. There's a cute way of reading a Gemara that if the czar, if the stranger is not praising you, that you have to praise yourself. So, and there's a Rivaka Venden has a piece where he says, is it Rivaka? I think it's Rivaka Venden, that today's day and age, we don't need to be modest. If you know a lot of Torah, you can let people know you out of Torah, because there's a lot of phonies out there. And the phonies are telling people they know a lot of Torah. So if you know a lot of Torah, you can. So I had a whole correspondence with Rabbi Oretz, also Rabbi Beshefkin, Rabbi Dov Beshefkin, because Rabbi Dov Beshefkin wrote about this as well. And he's very self-effacing. On his actual book, one of his books he published, and it was also on his website, he says, he gives his biography, and then he says, Dov Beshefkin, you know, he went to school here, here. And then at the end, he says, and Rabbi Beshefkin has lost out on a number of prestigious awards. And he has, he describes in one of his articles, or, and also he spoke about it, why he says that. Because everyone talks about all the big things they won. And he should let people know, you know, but it's incredible when you see it in print after giving his biography and said that he's lost out on some prestigious awards. And in one of his books, he discusses this. Yes, so you can find, so we had a long correspondence, and all three of us, you can find sources, but it bothers me. What can I tell you? It bothers me. It bothers me for big Talmid HaChamim. I'll respect the Talmid HaChamim, and we'll all respect the big Talmid HaChamim. But we don't need the big Talmid HaChamim to themselves to put on their website how great they are. Because I've been with Talmid HaChamim, and they never would speak like this. And these people who put it on their website wouldn't speak like this. But how could they put it on their website then? It's beyond me. I don't understand it. Despite the fact that you can find justification for it. Rabbi Kamenetsky and the Grosh were briefly classmates at Slobodka. I have to check that, Bill, if the times actually overlapped. I'm not sure exactly. Rabbi Shudnow says they study with Nelson Kamenetsky at BMT and with the Grosh at JTS. By the way, no one I knew thought of Lieberman as a conservative Jew. He wasn't a conservative Jew. We're going to see a letter. He always says he's not a conservative Jew. We're going to see a letter where he states explicitly, I'm not. But that doesn't matter. We heard from Meshulam. He could be a Satmar Chassid, but he's working with the conservatives, and he's not just working. That was when he began. That was problem number one. Now he's imprimatur, stands behind them. They're becoming rabbis. So I guess Liebman could justify himself that, yes, his imprimatur. They're not becoming rabbis for the Orthodox. They're becoming rabbis for conservative shuls. So he's doing his best to make sure that these people who go out and take conservative pulpits encourage Shabbos, encourage Kashrus, you know, try to teach Torah to these people who, if it wasn't these rabbis, it's going to be left-wingers, you know, really radicals. So that's how I guess Lieberman justified it to himself. And Bill says a number of Hasidic Sfarim on Zmanim lift ideas and even paragraphs. Bill Gewertz is an expert in Zmanim. They lift ideas and even paragraphs from Sekhet Shuto without even mentioning his name. Even his great Chidushim are unique with him. Look, you have plenty of that also. But remember, we'll see next class. Remember Acher? We'll see Acherim Omrim. We'll get to that. And someone privately texted, she never heard of Rabbi Lieberman until this class. She went to Brera, grew up modern Orthodox. Believe me, you wouldn't have heard about Lieberman. And I told you earlier, you could sometimes meet these yeshiva people, young people, and they don't really know what to make of him because they've never heard his term, they heard of him. Their idea is that he's like maybe a conservative rabbi, but he knew a little. And they have this idea that like a 17 and 18 year old who's been learning, let's say, in Lakewood for the last 10 years knows more than Lieberman because they know conservative. I mean, it's like I told you I was with this 80 year old rabbi, a well-known rabbi. Many people know his name. And he actually asked me, he said to me, did Lieberman also know Bafli or only Yerushalmi? But it gets better. Because I went to be a scholar in residence and that very shul. Okay, this guy was a kanai, they told me, a crazy guy. But he said that they shouldn't have me speak because of I'm writing about Lieberman. And that shows I'm sympathetic to the conservative movement. So I'm puzzled because I wrote a booklet on Lieberman. So I had to send them the booklet on Lieberman because someone said, what are you talking about? It's a scholarly book. It's so I mean, it just shows how sometimes people don't know something. And that's bad enough. But if they don't know, they don't know. You know, if you know that you don't know, okay. But if you don't know that you don't know, regarding cheerleaders, Eli says, there were no cheerleaders at MTA basketball games from 53 to 57. Well, that this is at BTA. This is the Brooklyn. You had to go to BTA. I don't know when Central Manhattan was founded, but we're talking BTA here. Why did Rabbi Gifter look down on Bernard Revel? Because he thought that Bernard Revel was created a college which allowed ideas to be taught in the college that were not in line with Orthodox thought. Because if you want to have a real university, you have to have all sorts of ideas in the library and academic Jewish studies. That was taught there. We'll get to that, because wait till you hear about how Shaul Lieberman attacks Solomon Zeitlin. Solomon Zeitlin taught at the graduate school, he taught at Yeshiva College. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik went crazy over this. But the Rabbi Revel's idea was that in a university, we don't censor, you can have professors who are not observant. Everything that a university is, a liberal arts college, was things that Rabbi Gifter was not comfortable with. And here you had, he says in the letter, that Rabbi Gifter obviously was telling people, why do you have to go off to Lithuania to learn? You could stay here and learn. So there's reasons. It wasn't just Rabbi Gifter. Agudas Rabbanim, which were the big backers of Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Hanan, once Revel took over, many of them were alienated from it because they weren't in control, and they wanted a college that also, they wanted a yeshiva that had a little college, but Revel wanted a real academic institution, so that created some problems. Yes, Rabbi Gifter was in Portsmouth, Virginia. Morris said Rav Gorin recounted his learning prowess and accomplishments in his autobiography. Yes, he did. Those were interviews that were then put into written form. And there's other examples. Sometimes you look at the introduction of Sfarim and they tell you, they write about how I was such an Eloy and there was no one in the town I could learn with, so I went off. You have examples of that. So you're right. We have some examples of it. But that also I find problematic when they write that. Rav Gorin did recount his prowess. 100% he recounted it. As did Halivni. In Halivni, not just once, but a number of times in his autobiography. And Baruch says, with his good limud schus, perhaps the website descriptions are penned by the Rebbetzins. And of course, the rabbis never look at the website to see what's on there, so they don't know. Okay, thank you all again for coming out. Rabbi Kelman.
I will tell you just one thing. We had the pleasure of having Rabbi Weiss Halivni here for Shabbos once. And first of all, Elliot did a fascinating interview with him about his experiences. It was Holocaust Education Week, about 10 years ago. And I can tell you he spent the entire weekend, unless he was talking to us, he was learning. And he came to us. I wasn't home. He was sitting in my study. He didn't want to touch anything. He was sitting there learning. All he did was learn the whole thing. And he gave me Musser because I didn't have a Yerushalmi here. And he said, how can you have it? But my kids, they were younger. They were blown away. They found themselves all. We had many, many speakers in our house over the years. And Baruch Hashem over Shabbos. Lots of people. And our kids still to this day talk about how impressed they were with Halivni and the way he talked to them. And of course, his knowledge was amazing. And because he asked kids what they were learning, he knew. He said by the age of 9, he knew Bava Kama and Bava Metzia word for word Baal Peh. And he talked about, Gemara was his, like taking his mother's milk. That's what it was like for him to learn Gemara. And he sat here like no other speaker we've ever had, sitting and learning Mama Shioman Balila. So you were talking about that when, you saw him at the library at Hebrew U. So I just wanted to mention that. I just thought that was,
What I was impressed about the Hebrew U is that, you can do what he was doing at home. I would have thought he'd have, let's say, the Ritva and the Rashba and everything, because he quotes them, obviously, he knows them. I was just so impressed that he just sat there, and that's all he wanted to do. He just wanted to learn Shas, just Rashi, Gemara, Tosfos. And I thought was interesting that and he didn't move. He was there at the beginning and the last one out. That I just thought was interesting.
Yeah. Anyways, listen, it's what can we say? It was like you say, orthodoxy was different back then. Everything was different then. Yes, I did notice the what happened in the conservative movement this week. The two rabbis live in Toronto, by the way. one of them was a rabbi literally two blocks from my house, about a 2-minute walk from our house. Anyways, okay, that's the world we live in. Okay, everybody, tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Rachel Sharansky Danziger continuing on Bereshit, human relations, and we look forward to learning with you, seeing with you, invite your friends, and everybody have a wonderful week. All our regular shiurim during the week, Thursday night, the Parsha Shir this week is Rav Gedalia Berger. teaching at GPATS at Stern. And okay, we look forward to learning with you. Have a wonderful night, everybody. Laila Tov.